Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It seems that every day we witness or hear news of something happening as a result of climate change, whether we're watching the impact of drenching rains and flooding, sinkholes or landslides or raging forest fires claiming thousands of acres and destroying homes and neighborhoods, or rising sea levels claiming beachfront houses. All these things are due to climate change. And it will likely get worse before it gets better, if it ever gets better. One thing you may not see, however, is the impact of the changing climate on agriculture. Most of us never visit a farm. So the soonest we notice the impact of that on agriculture is when the things we buy in the grocery store become exorbitantly expensive or unavailable. But farmers are having to deal with this right now, and many are searching for innovative solutions and finding some that hold promise. During this NPR Climate Solutions Week, which focuses on the future of food, we will do exactly that this hour. We're joined by Zachary Turner, who covers all of this for WFAE News. He is our climate reporter. Lee Holcomb is Assistant State Conservationist to Field Operations for the North Carolina USDA. And Russell Hedrick is a farmer in Catawba County practicing what is called regenerative agriculture. He's the co-owner of Soil Regen, a company that consults farms on sustainable agriculture. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program.
Morning, Mike.
Morning.
So let me start with you, Zach. You're our climate guy. According to NPR, farms and farmers face challenges in this warming climate, but they also contribute to climate change, farms and farming. They say that food and agriculture makes up more than 25% of the pollution that heats the planet. So my first thought was, when I read that, okay, well, they got tractors and they got farm equipment and they're all burning diesel or gasoline and the fumes are spewing out and they have to transport their food in trucks to the market. And that's what's doing this. Well, that's part of it, but it's not the biggest contributor. What is?
No, not necessarily. And it's great to be here on NPR's Climate Week while we're searching for these food solutions and looking at the future of food as it relates to climate change. So going beyond just sort of what is happening in terms of fossil fuel combustion on farms, there's also the issue of waste, food waste after we've consumed food. So in the U.S. alone, we've got 170 million metric tons of carbon dioxide that is associated with food waste. That's the equivalent of running 42 coal power plants. Beyond that, just in terms of inputs that are going into these farms, we have to look at fertilizers. That is like one of the largest sort of users of natural gas in the farming process. It's going into using natural gas combustion to fuel the production of fertilizers, but it's also a key component in making nitrogen-based fertilizers. And that is part of what is fueling climate change and warming the atmosphere.
And it's when it comes to food waste, that's not the farm. That's not completely the farmer's problem. That's our problem. That's something that we do when we toss things into the garbage disposal or into the trash can after we fix too much more food than we can eat, I suppose. But the other problem I've read about is the consumers' increased demand for beef. So farmers are responding to that demand, but if we throw away significant portions of the food we buy and make demands on farmers for certain products that are not necessarily all that sustainable, we're the problem, right?
Yeah, so there's definitely, like, when we're talking about the breakdown of carbon emissions from different types of produce, like, a big thing that people think of in terms of how can I reduce my personal carbon emission footprint is eating locally. And that really depends on what you're eating. So if you're eating a lot of beef or other meat products, well, transportation is going to be a very small, like proportionally, it's going to be a lot smaller percentage of the total carbon pollution emission, like the carbon pollution that's coming from that particular type of produce. But when you're looking at something like fruits and nuts, then yeah, if you're eating locally, then that's going to be cutting away the transportation aspect, which is proportionally a lot bigger part of the carbon emissions from that type of produce.
So the University of Michigan and the Ford Motor Company, so I want people to know who did this survey. You can consider the source, the Ford Motor Company and the University of Michigan, which happens to be the state in which Detroit is located. Just put it all together now. They did an experiment and they found that buying pre-proportioned meals to cook at home, like those you would buy from HelloFresh, or it used to be available in boxes in the grocery store for a while that now seem to have disappeared. That actually helps the environment. Now, I used to buy these things, and I would complain about how much waste there was because everything, every ingredient was individually packaged in a little plastic envelope. And I thought, my gosh, I got a trash can full of plastic stuff here from fixing this one food. But there was very little, if any, waste because everything is completely proportioned. And they say, counterintuitively, that is actually better for the environment. They also say, and I don't understand this at all, that ordering groceries to be delivered to your home is more efficient than you going and getting it yourself. Do you understand that saying?
Yeah, I understand what they're trying to say. I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about. Food waste is a huge part of total emissions coming from food, after production. And once we receive the food, if we're not composting it correctly, or if we're not using all of it, then it's going to a landfill where it's not decomposing properly. And that's contributing to a lot of this carbon pollution. However, there are other issues to consider. If you're just looking at that one metric, then yes, getting these pre-portioned meals, these meal kits, yeah, that might help you cut down on food waste because you're using all of it. You're not having leftovers that go to waste. But you also have all of the plastic pollution from these hydrocarbons that it's coming in. So you're getting a lot of plastic pollution. You're getting a lot of trash that comes along with it. So on one hand, yes, if you're using all of that food, that is helping cut down your carbon pollution on one side. But on the other end, you're ending up with a lot of these products that can't necessarily be recycled, and you cannot kind of return that back into the circular economy, and that's going to waste. And it also requires a lot of gas and energy in order to produce some of those plastics that you use to transport those meals. We have seen that. I know that grocery delivery services have become a lot more popular since the pandemic. And since those can be sort of coordinated and you can kind of get multiple deliveries done at one time when you go out to deliver those foods, that can be sort of efficient as opposed to something like DoorDash, where you're delivering individual meals to people. Then, sort of that, the carbon pollution from your car, transporting meals to individual houses, going one at a time, that doesn't work out as well. But when you're able to coordinate those sources, that actually can have a positive environmental impact if you're able to afford those services.
Yeah, and I guess in part that makes a difference because it's one vehicle making multiple deliveries as opposed to 10 vehicles going out and doing 10 trips to the grocery store. But we are here to talk about the other side of the food equation, and that is farming. And Lee Holcomb is with us. He is the Assistant State Conservationist of Field Operations for the North Carolina USDA. Lee, WRAL Television in Raleigh says that 65%. That's 65 counties because we have 100 counties in North Carolina. 65% of the counties, the farms there, have suffered agricultural losses due to extreme weather just this year. And the USDA reports that August's Tropical Storm Debby resulted in agricultural losses in 30% of the state's counties, which were ironically suffering through a drought. So put those numbers into perspective. How do they compare with other years?
Well, I think, Mike, I think anytime you look at those weather events, it obviously depends on the impacts and how many weather events we have. I think most years, if you think about the typical farmer, they worry about the row crop type farmer worries about prolonged drought, and what that can do to the overall yield of, our commodity crops such as soybeans and cotton, corn, and small grains, things like that. But I do think, certainly in eastern North Carolina where we get more of these, we worry about hurricane season, tropical storms, et cetera. We worry more about excess water and flooding and that causing disease issues that may affect the crop overall if it's trying to put on that grain. So I think the impact this year was that.
I guess my question is it, are you noticing an uptick? Are you noticing increased problems because of the weather, which is a direct correspondent to climate change?
Well, I definitely think that I think we're more aware, right, with social media and our abilities to get up to date. I definitely think the impacts that we have, they're more impactful, and it does seem like they're more, they can be more extreme as far as whether it's extremely dry or extremely wet. So it definitely.
Farming has never been easy, as any farmer will be first to tell you. And they're at the mercy of things that they are never going to be able to control. I don't care how advanced technology gets, the weather, you will never control it, and you can't predict it accurately far out. So between 2017 and 2022, the state lost 3,600 farms, which means that more than 300,000 acres of farmland fell out of use. Was most of that, do you think, because of the economics of farming and because of weather-related problems that exacerbated the negative aspects of the economics of farming? Or did the economics of farming lead these farmers to finally say, look, this land is more valuable if I sell it to a home builder than it is if I continue to farm it? Russell raised his hand. Russell Hedrick is with us. He is a farmer. Russell, take that question.
So, do you know what the most profitable crop is in North Carolina?
Houses.
Houses, solar panels. Farming is, I mean, if farming was easy, everybody would do it. And absolutely, it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of long hours. But when you have development that offers, you know, anywhere from 3 to 4 times the amount of money to buy the land, than what it's worth, so that they can subdivision it and develop it. And, you know, I would say the average crop in North Carolina probably makes, you know, on average, if you weigh in the good years, the bad years, maybe you're making $50 to $100 an acre a year if you're having some pretty good crops. And a solar farm comes along and says, hey, we're going to pay you $1,500 to $2,000 an acre to put this solar panel up with a 20 or 30 year guarantee. Well, that sounds pretty good, because then you don't have to worry about those hurricanes, and you don't have to worry about those droughts, and you have a guaranteed income. And so that's I think where we're seeing our farmland, its development, solar panels.
Well, you haven't succumbed. You have farms in Catawba and Lincoln counties. You have not succumbed. Are you seeing more and more of your colleagues just decide this is much easier and much wiser to go in this direction?
Oh,
And
I think it.
is climate change quickening that?
Well, I think climate change could have some issues with that, because I think we're seeing weather patterns on either side of the extreme. And you know, either we're extremely dry, we're extremely wet. There's not really a lot of in the middle of the road anymore when it comes to weather. But you know, some of the things that we've learned from the NRCS, and how I was actually introduced into Lee, was just something as simple as cover crops. Us working with Lee, you know, that was the first year that we had farmed, and Lee taught me about cover crops and how they sequester carbon and how that can help with climate change and doing stuff like that.
We're going to talk more about cover crops as an aspect of regenerative farming, which is something that you engage in. And a lot of people have never heard of regenerative farming. So we will explore that and other topics having to deal with farming and climate, because we all have to eat. This is important stuff. We're going to take a break. Come right back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about climate change with regard to farming, and will be a new concept to a lot of folks, something called regenerative farming, which we'll get to in a moment. Russell Hedrick is a farmer who practices regenerative farming. He owns farms in Catawba County and Lincoln County and is the co-owner of Soil Regen. Lee Holcomb is with us. He's assistant state conservationist to field operations with the North Carolina USDA, and WFAE's climate reporter Zach Turner is with us as well. The economics of farming have always been difficult, Zach, and climate change is probably making things much worse or much more difficult, as are the pressures of, do I keep this land as a farm, or do I make a lot more money by selling to a home builder, or do I make a lot more money by letting people put solar arrays or even windmills on my land? But when you put a solar array on farmland or windmills on farmland, can you not? And you may not know the answer to this question, Zach, but can you not farm around that? Can't you put strips of crops in between the solar panels?
I don't know about putting strips of crops in between solar panels, but a good friend of mine, Sophie Mallinson, had done a report on this when we were both at Chapel Hill together, looking at solar grazing. So there are some farmers that have actually taken their sheep is a good example. They're able to go to these solar farms and have them sort of mow the grass essentially around these solar panels. So there are some opportunities for a sort of modernized version of silvopastures, which is basically where you're using the land for multiple purposes at the same time. A good example of this is like if you've ever been on the Blue Ridge Parkway and you wander up onto a trail through the woods and the mountains, you might find some cows grazing in between apple trees. And you'll see this sort of multiple land use playing out. And this is a very modernized version of that, having these sheep graze in between solar panels and keep that grass down.
Lee, I know you want to talk about conservation easements, and I'm assuming, I know just enough about this to be incredibly dangerous, but I'm assuming that has to do with the pressure on farms to sell out to home builders for construction purposes. But conservation easements come into play, and North Carolina's USDA has some things to say about that.
Absolutely, Mike. I know that because of development pressure here in North Carolina, USDA, NRCS, who I work for specifically, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, we are offer some financial incentives, essentially some development rights to purchase that, so that way that land can stay in farmland use in the perpetuity, so that will not later become a subdivision, et cetera. So, and we also have some state partners that help with financial assistance as well. So we're seeing a huge uptick in that, producers, families seeking out that assistance that do want to see their farm stay in farmland for forever.
Not every farm and not every farmer is on the verge of extinction. Some of them are doing rather well, and one of them is with us. Russell Hedrick is doing rather well, partly because of his use of regenerative farming, which we're going to get into here. But we have farms around Catawba County and around Hickory, in Lincoln County. You're a first-generation farmer, so you're learning on the job, I guess, in a way. But you also practice and you speak about conservation. Is that typical or atypical of most farmers? Are they into conservation?
I don't think most farmers want to speak to anybody outside of the farm. I think being from outside of farming and learning new things really did make me want to share with others and talk to them about some of our successes and failures. And we just want to see farms succeed. And that's why we do the education and do the farm consulting. It's just to help farmers make money at farming and be the best environmental stewards that they can be.
And some farmers who've had these farms passed down through the generations may be reluctant to listen to somebody like you, who's a newcomer to this, a first generation farmer, but you have had, and we'll talk about this, remarkable success. I guess that gives you field cred, correct?
I guess it does a little bit. You know, the hard work and the plots. I mean, we do anywhere from 40 to 60 different trials and plots, and we take it all the way to yield and look at return on investment. And those are the ways that we're able to, you know, share that information with farmers, what worked and what didn't.
So you have a little more than we have a lot. How many acres do you have? I have 800 here, but you have more than that.
It definitely changes every single year. You know, this year I know there's three farms that we farm right now that they're already driving stakes in it, and there's going to be houses on it before our next crop, so we'll lose those acres. So it really does fluctuate every single year, and it goes anywhere. You know, some of our years we've been down to 600, and some years we've been up to 1400, but about that 800 to 1000 range is typically what it's at.
And what do you grow?
Predominantly we grow mostly grain. We grow a lot of open pollinated old varieties of corn from the early 1800s, like Jimmy Red, Bloody Butcher. There's a blue corn the Hopi Indians grew called Blue Hopi. You know, that's probably what, 400 to 600 years old at some point. We've got a green corn. We grow soybeans in our rotation. We grow small grain like hard red winter wheats, soft red winter wheats, and then we grind those up into cornmeal and flours and different things for our customers.
And how long have you been at this?
This is my 12th season in agriculture.
Okay, so 12 years. Have you seen any noticeable changes or noticeable challenges arrive because of climate change over that time?
I have. You know, I think a lot of people, and I could be wrong, I'm just a farmer, but, you know, from what I see, I think in North Carolina, farmers are dealing with climate change, but I don't think it's on the, you know, the 60,000 foot level where we talk about CO2 in the atmosphere and the, you know, planet temperature changing. To me, I see more farmers facing climate change from sensible heat from urban sprawl in the cities. I have seen, you know, rain clouds are coming into Greensboro, North Carolina, and they'll literally split apart and go up and around. And I have friends that farm in, you know, Julian, just a little bit of south of Greensboro. And as that city has expanded over the last 10 years, their rain clouds have dissipated. We've seen the same thing at, you know, our farm here with, you know, hickory and things kind of spreading out. I've got friends that farm even in the eastern part of the state at Greenville, North Carolina. They're seeing the same thing from that sprawl of Eastern Carolina University.
I used to do the weather on television 100 years ago, and I'm not a meteorologist, but I used to present the weather after having spoken to meteorologists. And there is that phenomenon where the heat from cities pushes the air up and splits the clouds, and so the rain goes around. I saw it as a problem inside cities like Charlotte, but you're saying
sensible heat.
But it's a problem for farmers is what you're saying too. Why? Because it spreads the clouds so far out, you don't get the rain either?
Yeah, I think as we see cities expand, they're coming towards our farmland. And as they expand and that sensible heat creates a heat dome, then it starts pushing the rain from around those heat domes. And as cities keep coming into the farmland, it keeps pushing rainfall off of the farmland more and more and more as the city expands. And that's what I've seen as a big one outside of CO2 in the atmosphere.
So Lee, we have that as a phenomenon. Oh, go ahead, Zach, if you want to chime in before I launch on to something
else.
I had an opportunity
to talk to an atmospheric scientist at UNC Charlotte, Matt Easton, kind of about this phenomenon, because I was talking with Russell about this on his farm, about how our built environment can have impacts on regional weather patterns, since that was something that he said was more of a concern for him than some of these climate impacts that we are seeing. And what Easton said was that, yes, it does have an impact on regional weather, these large in urban areas, but maybe not quite in that same way. So if you have a storm system that is heading your way and it's going to pass through Charlotte, from an atmospheric perspective, Charlotte is not the same as, say, like a mountain that's going to give you that sort of rain shadow effect. But what is happening over Charlotte that is similar to what Russell was talking about is you have that urban heat dome effect where you have this very hot concrete, you have a very warm area just above the surface of the ground. That heat is rising and you have clouds forming over top of Charlotte. And what that also means is it's almost kind of magnetic in a sense that all of the water that is accumulating, all the moisture that is accumulating in the atmosphere, it wants to collect above the city. And that means you're going to have more rainfall on the other side of the city in the direction that the wind is blowing. So in this case, We get, I think, southwest winds blowing from the southwest here in Charlotte most typically. And that means you're going to see more rainfall over the course of the year in areas like Concord. That also means it's going to be a little bit drier in areas like Pineville. So if you happen to be, or Gastonia. So if you're farming in those areas, you might see a 10 to 20% difference in the amount of rain that you're receiving over the course of the year. But it's not quite like these cities aren't quite big enough from an atmospheric perspective to like really break apart a large storm system if it's moving over top of them.
Russell.
So you're saying Charlotte is farming my rain clouds away from me, Zach? Is that what I'm hearing?
In a sense, that the atmosphere, it's going to give it a preference, is how Easton described it for me. Those clouds, if they're going to form, if it's going to rain, it's going to want to do it over top of Charlotte, and then that wind is going to push it towards Concord.
Yeah.
So Lee, we have this phenomenon, which is localized around urban areas, I suppose, but you also have the phenomenon of normal cyclical droughts and cyclical heavy amounts of rainfall and years when crops don't do so well and years when we have bumper crops. But we also have the exacerbation of climate change, which is changing everything. And it's causing some crops to migrate from their traditionally preferred growing areas to other areas because it's too hot now in some places to grow certain things. So are farmers on their own in dealing with all this? How much help do they get from either the state government or the federal government, from the USDA, et cetera, to help them weather these storms? No pun intended.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. So we, like I said, I work for NRCS. We have our sister agencies, such as the Farm Service Agency, Rural Development. So we are NRCS. We have these what we call our flagship farm bill programs, such as the Environmental Quality Incentives Program and then the Conservation Stewardship Program, where they are trying to incentivize maybe higher levels of conservation. And so there's a monetary benefit from that. It's not 100% paid for. It's what we call cost share. And so to do things like Russell has shared earlier on his row crop farm, such as cover crops, you think about livestock producers. I'm a livestock producer myself with sheep. And so you think about things, what Zach's touched on, silvopasture, maybe planting trees, if it's just a forest land producers at a higher rate to try to sequester more carbon. So there are programs that are involved with all types of producers across the state.
This is sounding very scientific, and I would think that for particularly people who have majored in agriculture, and maybe this is part of it. If you major in agriculture, you learn these things, but maybe you don't major in agriculture. Maybe you've inherited this farm. Farming goes years and years and years through your family. How equipped are farmers to deal with all of this today? Because this is science.
Yeah, it's so there's a lot at stake as far as just the information sharing, right? I mean, when you meet someone, you come into an office, let's say a USDA office. Russell can speak on this. When I used to work in his county, there is a little bit of a learning curve there. We have information sharing, which is great, but because we have so much information out there, it's hard to tell me just what the basic facts are and what may help me on my farm. And so that's
One
the
of
real
the
challenge.
one of the things that we have learned over the years on doing this program on all the topics that we cover is that there are limited numbers of clearing houses for informations in various fields of study, like law enforcement. We know that the law enforcement agencies at various levels don't necessarily exchange or trade information that would be valuable to all of them collectively because the mechanism simply hasn't been set up to do so. Is it the same with agriculture?
Yes.
I can share my agency perspective. There's a lot of in North Carolina, where the North Carolina is the Anson County, Brown Creek Soil and Water. We are the home of Soil Conservation Service for across the whole entire country. So Hugh Hammond Bennett started the Soil Conservation Service, which is now NRCS. So I would say North Carolina is the home of conservation. So I think we have a unique, there's a difference here in North Carolina where we work a lot with state, local, and federal partners to really try to bring the information to folks like Russell. But there is challenges. And so I guess what I would say, Mike, is when you have a sweet spot where everybody's getting along really well and all agencies are working on, they understand each other, I think Russell could speak on this. When it's good, we can really do a lot of benefit. So Russell,
Russell, Russell and Zach want to get on this. So Russell, go ahead. You're first.
So when I first started farming, I didn't even know what no-till was. I thought we took a tractor, we were going to till the ground and plant into it, and you just dealt with erosion and all that. And I went to my local soil and water district, and I was worried about winter erosion and winter weeds. And I always joke, and I say, Lee, it was kind of like a cover crop drug deal. He kind of poked his head out of his NRCS door, and he said, "Hey, let me tell you about cover crops. Come in here for a minute." And I was a recipient of some of those programs that Lee's talking about. You know, we had an EQIP contract that kind of helped offset that financial risk of planting a cover crop and maybe having an issue with it or a crop production issue while we were learning it the first few years. And I think that is a really good tool that is probably underutilized in most states because they didn't replicate Lee Holcomb and put him in all the NRCS offices. You know, going to 46 states now, I've met good people, and I've met people that, you know, they're there to get a paycheck, and you know, they continue to push and do as good of a job as they can. But a lot of people don't know Lee went above and beyond for the farmers here in Catawba County when he was here, and I hated to see him go away. So Lee, come on back to Catawba at some point.
Zach, you want to chime in here? But we have about a minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just one of my favorite stories when I was talking to both Lee and Russell was about when Russell had gotten that EQIP grant back in 2012, and how well his cover crops had taken off right off the bat. And I think Lee could probably tell the story a little bit better, just about like in terms of when that first blend that Russell had done, this combination of grasses that he's planting in the off season. That's what these cover crops are. It's these non-commodity crops that you're using to hold down the soil, prevent erosion, and then ultimately return carbon back into the soil. They took off almost too well. And I think, what did both of you are a little bit over 6 foot tall, right? These grasses had grown up to be about your height.
I'm 6 foot 5, and I think Russell's 6 foot 3, and it got that tall. And so Russell listened to me, and it worked out great.
So, we've just mentioned cover crops again. You mentioned no-till farming a moment ago, Russell. There's also the idea of cattle, and all of this is part of regenerative farming, which we have not talked about yet because I'm a bad guy and I got off on the tangents. So when we come back, that's what we will discuss in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE in Hickory. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about farming, climate change, and now we're going to launch into regenerative farming with Zach Turner, our climate reporter here at WFAE News, Lee Holcomb, Assistant State Conservationist of Field Operations with the North Carolina USDA, and Russell Hedrick, who is the co-owner of Soil Regen, which is a company that helps other farmers do this, but he himself is a farmer. In Catawba and Lincoln County. So we're going to talk about this technique that you're using, Russell, that appears to be working very well for you, called regenerative farming. What is it?
I think regenerative farmer, just it's a definition that's different for every farmer, and I hope the USDA doesn't put a label on it. But essentially, there's six soil health principles: cover the soil, reduce disturbance, animal integration. There's all of these things that are within regenerative ag that essentially help heal the land, bring it back into better production, gives it more resiliency to climate change, and ultimately that's what we've been tracking.
And this is something that truly is working for you. I understand that in North Carolina, the average farm produces about 60 bushels of farm per acre, 60. You are producing this year more than twice that, 150 bushels. Despite drought, you're going to have a better than average crop. That's all due to regenerative farming?
Yeah, when we first started farming and doing cover crops, everybody said we were crazy. It was a waste of money. And honestly, Lee was kind of like a therapist at that point. He just kept telling me, wait till a dry year, wait till a dry year. Our first dry year was 2015, and the Catawba County average in corn that year, I believe, was 9 or 10 bushels, and our farm was 125. And then this year we've had another dry year, and, you know, once again, county average will probably be around 40, and we'll probably be around 150. So regenerative farming definitely has made our soils more resilient to climate change impacts, to weather events.
And in fact, in 2022, with corn, you set a record, 459.51 bushels of corn per acre in a year in which the state average was 140. So that's what you are experiencing with corn, but you also grow soybeans and wheat and barley and other small grains. Are you experiencing anything similar with those crops?
Yeah, we set a state record in soybeans in 2021 of 117 bushels, which I think the state average that year was about 40 to 45.
So this sounds to be remarkable, almost magical, but it's not. It's all based on science, Lee. How difficult, Zach, did you want to get in? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was going to, well, what I wanted to clarify or talk a little bit about, too, is just in terms of these, like, climate impacts that are impacting, or what regenerative agriculture is helping Russell sort of overcome here. It's not necessarily that our these weather patterns, we're seeing more frequent extreme weather events. It's more so that when we are getting these, like, dry spells and we are getting these intense rainfalls, it's happening more severely. I've had this described to me as a sort of weather roller coaster event. And so when you say it's kind of like magic, the some of the science behind this is that what Russell is effectively trying to do is restore a lot of the carbon to his soil. And that's so, what he's doing with the, go ahead.
I was going to say, there is science behind this, and that's where I was going with this with Lee. How difficult is this as a concept and as a practice to adapt to, particularly if you've been doing this your own way for a long time, and suddenly this new thing is producing all these crops that you'd like to be able to take advantage of, but you have to know stuff.
Yeah, I think Russell could add to this too, as far as it's a huge learning curve. And I think that, you know, you have to depend on, there has to be research, right? The only issue with research is if you do it on a controls and variables standpoint, we still have to have the people like Russell who are doing what we call on-farm research. And when you do the on-farm research, you can really see what's the benefit. And then someone like Russell can then relay that practical information to another producer in his county. And a lot of this, you know, even relays to other states. A lot of it's about soil types. It's about, I think Russell or Zach touched on this too, it's organic matter. You know, what we're trying to do with this regenerative farming, it's not a miracle cure. It's a risk. You're mitigating risk. So if you can make your soils more resilient, you're mitigating risk from these extreme events. So
I know that you are looking at things going on your farm, Russell, almost on a leaf by leaf basis, if that's accurate. I mean, you're trying to figure out the exact, I'm going to do this from memory. You're trying to figure out the exact proportion of fertilizer to the crops that you're growing from field to field, and you're doing it by keeping intense records and measuring things, even taking tissue samples of the plants you're growing. This is like working in a lab. Talk about this.
So that was kind of a joke when we first started farming, and I was very computer illiterate, and everybody called me the notebook man. We kept 3-ring binders with every input we used and all of these plots, and, you know, I think technology is catching up so fast with my generation of farmers that we're even utilizing AI technology now. We built a program about 5 years ago, and we've been using it for 5 years. And then there is another company called AgWise that helped us commercialize it, where even other farmers can now use it. And utilizing AI technology, we used to look at applying fertilizer in pounds, or sometimes for like tissue sampling and foliar applying, where you spray fertilizer on the actual plant, which is more efficient. You kind of had to take a guess. And now with this AI technology, we know down to the ounce how much fertilizer we need to put on a plant.
So I would take it that saves you money.
A boatload of money. Absolutely. You know, somewhere in the neighborhood of anywhere from $30 to $100 an acre.
So when you're saving money and you're having bumper crops, it all adds up.
That's what makes farming profitable. The old status quo way of farming of let's just put fertilizer out here, let's just go make this chemical pass. One, we know that that's not good for the environment and our impact on climate change on farming side. And then also where we've seen, you know, since 2021, we've seen inputs increase 200 to 300%. It's just not economical to continue to farm that way.
And Lee, Russell credits you for advising him to incorporate cattle into his system of farming. He credits you with showing him the benefits. What are the benefits? How does this work? Because I thought that cattle is part of the problem because of the methane gas that they belch out.
Well, I think, Mike, a lot of that incorporation is the recycling, the upcycling, I guess I would say, of those nutrients. So, you know, oftentimes when we're integrating the cattle, the livestock, it's usually with a cover crop. So if we plant this cover crop after our commodity crop, and then it comes up and then we're able to use cattle to harvest that, then we're putting pounds of gain on the beef. They're in turn urinating, defecating on the soil that's going to be farmed. That's organic nitrogen, you know, organic. So we're increasing the biology, the soil biology. So that's all good things. Instead of a chemistry kit, we're putting out, you know, what comes from nature, what comes from these ruminants, such as beef cattle. And so we're really upcycling that, and we're able to get a product with livestock, but also return something back for the next cash crop as well.
Russell.
And one of the things I think a lot of people don't consider is the carbon increase with cattle. So when I grow a cover crop and we lay that cover crop on the ground, roughly about 50% of that residue actually off-gases back into CO2 in the atmosphere. Having, you know, one of the things I learned from Lee is having that split hoof animal where that cattle is grazed across that land, it actually shallow incorporates more of that residue in the top layer of the soil. And so the biology can break it down and increase our carbon uptake in the soil instead of off-gassing. So to give just a rough estimate, we have mapped carbon all the way back to 2013, and we're anywhere between 9 to 10.2 tons of carbon increase per acre every year.
Zach, from your reporting, and I don't know that you can answer this question either, but how widespread is this style of farming across the state of North Carolina or even across the country? Is he an outlier? Is Russell like at the tip of the spear here, or is he just one of many?
You know, this is kind of tough to say, I feel like, because it goes back to sort of what Russell was saying about how he hopes that there's not a definition for regenerative farming, like a concrete set of standards, perhaps, because it's so regional dependent. Mm. What's going to be good for your soil health is going to vary tremendously just based on your environment and the ecosystems around you. So if you go look at soil, even in Catawba County versus somewhere in the coastal plains where you have more sandy soil, what you're going to need to do to improve or restore soil health is going to be extremely variable. Looking at some of the ways that Russell and Lee are talking about implementing livestock, that's a little bit different than some of traditional agricultural methods, such as using these concentrated animal feeding operations where that waste is not being incorporated as well. I know in North Carolina, this is a big issue with hog farms, and there's a definite climate tie-in here because that becomes a huge issue where you have these large precipitation events, and not only are you dealing with excess nutrients and tributaries and rivers and streams, but you're also having fecal contamination when these hog lagoons flood. And that can be a huge public health issue.
You said, Russell, that you hoped the USDA would not label regenerative farming. And I think that you meant that in terms of their prescribing exactly what it is. If you're going to practice it, this is how you must do it because you're still experimenting with it. But when you grow crops organically and they appear on grocery store shelves, they are labeled as organic and they go through a certification process so that people buying those products know that they are in fact organic, and they're paying a premium for those. Would it be helpful to those of you who go to all this trouble to practice regenerative farming and do all the things that you're talking about having to do that ordinary farming doesn't do? Would it be helpful for you from a marketing point of view for you to be able to slap a label on an ear of corn that says, this came from regenerative farming?
Honestly, my real opinion is absolutely not.
Okay.
Organic has been stagnant now for about, 10, maybe 15 years. It got about 10% of our acres. We haven't seen any increase in organic acres in the U.S. in probably the last 4 to 5 years. And just because you put a label on something doesn't automatically mean that it's better. I think the root of regenerative is, I think, more localized than what we're going to see with organic. We have customers that, you know, we just had a field day on Monday. We had 150 people, farmers, local customers. We had people from 16 different states that came to learn about these regenerative practices. And I think it goes back to what Lee said. I think the NRCS's role is to make farmers aware of regenerative or soil health principles. And then the same way that it happened for me, I had, you know, 4 or 5 farmers in North Carolina that were already doing these practices that I could reach out to. And they were like, hey, this worked, this didn't. And really that information exchange from farmer to farmer gave me the confidence to really follow through with these practices.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about what something you brought up a long time ago in this program, Russell, and that is no-till farming. Because when we think about farming, we always think about farmers, at least in the spring or before the planting, the growing season begins, out in the field with their tractor, tilling the soil, cutting rows into the soil and putting seeds into the soil so that they will grow. You don't do that. How do you get things to grow? How do you get the seeds to stay put?
It's really very simple, and I'm going to make this as simple as possible. Just imagine a round metal disc. They make a lot of different variations of it, but just imagine a metal disc that fractures 1/2 of an inch or maybe 5/8 of an inch of soil, and that's the only part that actually gets disturbed, and it's right in front of the planter row unit. And so instead of disturbing 100% of the soil, we're only disturbing maybe 5 or 10% of the soil.
And what's the benefit? What's the benefit of that?
So think about, you know, really water infiltration rates. In tilled ground, the water infiltration rate is only about 1/2 inch an hour. In our no-till fields with soil health principles, we're 14 to 16 inches of water infiltration per hour. So you get a really huge rainfall event. Our soil is able to soak that up and get that water in the soil so the crop can use it. And the other benefit to that is it doesn't end up in the streams and we don't end up with urban flooding as much. So there's huge impacts.
Through practicing some of the other things that we've talked about that you go through in your regenerative farming routine, Lee says that you are definitely a soil health regenerative farmer champion in North Carolina. Lee, is he leading the way? Are other farmers taking note of what he's accomplished here?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Russell's made a big impact since 2012, and he's always been kind to me to at least say good things about what we did 12 years ago. So I very much appreciate that. But yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, he's got some soil health champions with him in North Carolina across the whole state, Western, Piedmont, and Coastal Plains. So the great thing is there's not just one soil health champion in North Carolina in Russell. There's quite a few across the state. And so it's because of folks like Russell that continue to spread the word.
So I have 30 seconds left, Zach. This may not be a fair question because this is not just a local problem or a state problem or even a U.S. problem. It's a world problem because we're facing a growing population. And by, I think, 2050, the world population will be $9.8 billion people. Is it necessary, mandatory, that farmers adopt these policies?
From my perspective, from the climate perspective, yes, you might not be able to sequester as much carbon as might be suggested by some companies, but you are able to reduce a lot of the carbon that might be otherwise coming. You can reduce your footprint, and I think that is essential for farmers moving forward.
Zachary Turner is our climate reporter here at WFAE News. Lee Holcomb is assistant state conservationist to field operations with the North Carolina USDA, and Russell Hedrick is a Catawba County, Lincoln County farmer, co-owner of Soil Regen. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.